From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we examine why the coup in the Soviet Union failed and what lies ahead for the Soviet people. We talk with journalist Robert Cullen, author of a forthcoming book on the crumbling of the Soviet Empire. Also today, former CIA director Stansfield Turner considers the role of intelligence agencies in the coup, both the CIA and the KGB. And Soviet emigre writer Mikhail Yosel reads an excerpt from a new story about his grandfather, a hardliner from a previous generation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush called Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev today and was told that democracy has prevailed in the Soviet Union. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Broadcasting reports.
The president said Gorbachev sounded buoyant and in good physical condition. Mr. Bush called it a fine day, an emotional day.
It was good. It was a good talk. It's a good development.
The president had been trying to reach Gorbachev since the coup began, but did not get through until just shortly after noon. He said the two men talked for nearly 20 minutes. Mr. Bush said he and Gorbachev agreed the coup failed because its organizers underestimated the Soviet people's desire for freedom and democracy. Mr. Bush said the entire crisis has strengthened U.S.-Soviet relations, as well as relations with Boris Yeltsin and the leaders of the other Soviet republics that stood firm with Gorbachev and the constitutional government. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
According to air traffic controllers in the Crimea, Soviet President Gorbachev left his vacation home almost 2 hours ago and should arrive in Moscow within the hour. Outside the Russian Parliament building in Moscow today, crowds cheered and waved flags as Soviet armored columns withdrew from the capital. The tanks of units that sided with the protesters were strewn with flowers. The coup apparently collapsed today as the leaders of the Soviet legislature demanded Gorbachev's reinstatement. The full legislature nullified all the emergency decrees that had been issued by the coup leaders. The Soviet prosecutor's office announced a criminal investigation of the coup leaders' actions, and even the Communist Party denounced the takeover. NATO foreign ministers are keeping a close watch on events in the Soviet Union from a special meeting at NATO headquarters in Brussels. Paul de Meissenier has this report.
The emergency session of NATO foreign ministers had been underway for less than an hour when Secretary of State Baker issued a statement saying that events in the Soviet Union were moving in a positive direction. The special meeting virtually broke up into an informal session when NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner got in touch by telephone with Boris Yeltsin, a conversation that lasted for nearly 40 minutes. Although overtaken by events, the ministers did issue a final statement strongly condemning the conservative coup in Moscow and giving support to both Mr. Gorbachev and Mr. Yeltsin. At a news conference later, Mr. Baker, however, ruled out any major new American aid program for the Soviet Union. For National Public Radio, this is Paul de Meissenier in Brussels.
Stock prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street as traders reacted to the apparent end of the Soviet coup. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 88 points to close at 3,001.79. Advances led declines by a margin of about 7 to 1 in heavy trading of 232 million shares. This is NPR News. Prison officials in Alabama say that Cuban inmates have rioted at a federal penitentiary and are holding as many as 10 hostages. The inmates are said to have taken over part of the Cuban section of the Talladega Federal Prison. Officials say that 7 guards and 3 immigration staff members are unaccounted for and are believed to be hostages. The Cuban inmates were part of the 1980 Mariel boatlift. All were imprisoned after committing crimes in the United States. Most of the 121 Cubans housed in the section where the riot occurred are under orders to be deported. Tennessee Senator Albert Gore today added his name to the list of Democrats who will not run for president. Saying that he would like to be president, Gore concluded that his responsibilities as a father prevent him from running next year. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
In what seems an attempt to downplay his decision, Senator Gore issued a simple written statement on one of the busiest news days of the year, calling it a painful and difficult decision The Tennessee Democrat said that having run for president before, he knows what it means to a young family and, quote, I have learned that when you're running for president, it's tough to be there when your family needs you, unquote. Gore has four young children. Though the senator has reportedly told confidants over the last few weeks that he did not know whether he would run or not, the timing of the announcement today is likely to lead to speculation that President Bush's handling of the Soviet situation and preeminence in world affairs has scared off another Democrat. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar has appealed to the United States and the Soviet Union for help in ending the 11-year-old Salvadoran civil war. United Nations officials said the secretary called the superpowers for help about 2 days before the Soviet coup. Perez de Cuellar said he's ready to take a more personal role in the mediation. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The coup in the Soviet Union has failed. When we heard the news earlier today that Gorbachev was on his way back to Moscow, we called Robert Cullen for his assessment of why the coup failed and what lies ahead for the Soviet Union. Cullen writes about the Soviet Union for The New Yorker and The Atlantic, and he's the author of a forthcoming book on the crumbling of the Soviet Empire called Twilight of Empire. I asked him if he thinks the unsuccessful coup represents the last gasp of the hardliners.
I don't think that you can call it the last gasp of the hardliners. There remains the possibility that other hardliners who were not participants in this coup might at some time in the future find an opportunity to do something similar and perhaps try to do it more effectively. Don't forget that Gorbachev, in the most recent poll that I saw, had a 7% approval rating. If, as I suspect, he's going to now enter into a very difficult period where he gives away a great deal of authority to the republic governments and in a way that I think may be unwise, then the likelihood is that the Soviet Union is heading into a very chaotic period where the economy is not going to recover. And in those circumstances, a right-wing coup, a coup to restore order, is always at least a vague possibility. But I think it will be a while before the KGB and the security forces in general recover from the defeat that they apparently are suffering right now.
How much can we credit the failure of the coup to the power of the people, and how much of it do you think is just a sign of how badly managed the coup was?
I think that both are true. When I was in the Soviet Union in June talking to military officials about the possibility of a coup, I met with a general named Alexander Bajanov, who told me that there would have been a coup already if there were any social support for it. And I think he was correct in pointing out that you can't have a coup if the only people that support it are the army. Usually in a situation where a coup is sustained, it's because some elements in society are prepared to support it. And there were almost no elements in Soviet society prepared to support this one. I think that it was badly planned and that the military acted out of desperation as much as anything else, not out of conviction that they had a coup plan that would work. I think they felt that the only thing that they could do to preserve their own institutions and their own power in the society was to roll the dice and see what happened.
It looks like Gorbachev is returning to power. Do you think he's going to stay in power?
I would imagine that he'll probably be in office at least until next year, when there presumably will be elections for president of the Soviet Union. At the moment, it remains to be seen whether he could be elected president, but I think that he will at least retain power until those elections. Now, whether he will have real power remains to be seen as well. Clearly, he owes his job and maybe his life to Boris Yeltsin, and I don't think that Yeltsin is going to forget about that. And I think that Yeltsin is going to take advantage of the opportunity that he now has to consolidate a great deal of power in the office of the Russian presidency and to emasculate the president of the Soviet Union to the degree that he feels is necessary. So I am not sure how much authority Gorbachev will have, particularly inside the country. I think that Yeltsin may find that he prefers to have Gorbachev acting as a front man for the country and using his international prestige to help arrange economic assistance and so forth. But I can't imagine that Gorbachev will be able to tell Yeltsin much of anything as far as what he wants Yeltsin to do internally.
Are there any ways that you think Gorbachev's position will have been strengthened by the failed coup, in the sense that, you know, the popular support rallied around him for the first time in a really long time?
Popular support rallied around him, but I think that it really rallied around the concept of democracy and constitutional government much more than around Gorbachev personally. Clearly, I think that now people will realize a little bit more clearly the difficult position Gorbachev has been in over the last few years, trying to appease these hardliners and at the same time continue to move forward with reforms. And I think they may appreciate more the real risks that he faced as he pushed his reform programs. So it may be that there will be some more sympathy for the difficult position he's been in and the difficulties that any individual would have faced in his position. But I can't imagine that suddenly people who are standing in line for bread are going to start thinking Gorbachev is a great man.
Do you think the failed coup will bring new opportunities for Soviet democracy?
Yes, I do. First of all, I think that it probably means that there will no longer be much likelihood that the Soviets will hold on to the republics that are determined to break away. The fact that the military could not enforce its will in Moscow suggests that the time for enforced decision-making is over, and that any further arrangements will have to be dependent to some degree on the consent of the people involved, and those republics, particularly in the Baltic and the Transcaucasus and Moldavia, are not likely to give their consent to anything except independence. And I imagine that given Yeltsin's position that if they really want to be independent, they should be allowed to be independent, that they will somehow, someday soon, get that independence. Once that national issue is settled to some degree by consent, then I think that the likelihood of democracy putting down deeper roots is all the better, because the real disadvantage to democracy, insofar as the Russians have been concerned, I think, was this idea that, correctly speaking, that the democracy entailed the breakup of the Soviet Union. Now I think they've come to the point where, under Yeltsin's leadership, they can accept that, and therefore I think they're much more likely to concentrate on building a democratic market economy in Russia and to let the republics that don't want to stay in the Soviet Union leave.
So in some ways, the Soviet society might be more open now that the coup has failed. On the other hand, I wonder if they'll be more closing down in some respects. For instance, I could see the government being more fearful about another coup and trying to protect itself against the KGB or the military.
Well, I think that the only real protection against the military, it might be possible to dismantle to some degree the KGB, but I don't think that, and I certainly think the size of the Russian army, the Soviet army, will diminish, because the republics are not going to support a huge army of the type that the Soviet Union now has. I think that, apart from that, the real protection that any government has against a coup by the people who hold armed power in their hands is tradition, respect for constitutional institutions, and so on. And I think that the likelihood is that the Soviets have established, in effect, a new tradition here, and that it will be a long time before the army thinks about taking power into its own hands again.
You know, in trying to follow everything that's happened for the past couple of days, you can't help but think about the really strange relationship that Gorbachev and Yeltsin seem to have. You know, Gorbachev kind of banished Yeltsin just a few years ago, and then there was Yeltsin supporting Gorbachev. And what do you think the relationship's going to be like now?
I don't think it will be a friendly one, although they're both capable of putting up a pretense of friendship if their political interests require it. I think that Gorbachev and Yeltsin basically dislike each other. Gorbachev sees Yeltsin as an upstart usurper, a person who refused to play along the lines of Gorbachev's plan, even though Gorbachev was the one who brought him to Moscow and presumably thinks that Yeltsin should have been more loyal to him. Yeltsin, I think, sees Gorbachev as a part of the old order that he has a historical mission to change. And I don't think that their personal chemistry is particularly warm. On the other hand, they've shown in the past that they can be at each other's throats 1 month and then a few months later pretend that that never happened, and that for the sake of their own individual political interests, they can cooperate. So I would imagine that they will, for at least a time, get along fine, at least on the surface.
My guest is journalist Robert Cullen, the author of a forthcoming book on the crumbling of the Soviet Empire. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Robert Cullen, and he writes about the Soviet Union for The New Yorker and The Atlantic, and he's the author of a forthcoming book on the crumbling of the Soviet Empire called Twilight of Empire. What do you think of how President Bush handled himself during the crisis?
I imagine that it's hard to fault success, and Bush pretty much did what you would hope a president would do, that is to stake out a strong position, morally speaking, and not promise or threaten intervention. I think that it would have been a hollow threat, and if the promise had been made and then not kept, we would have borne some responsibility for what happened, and as we did, I think, in Eastern Europe in 1956. So I suspect that the president handled this particular aspect fairly well. As to how he's handled the Soviet-American relationship during the time he's been president, that's another question.
Okay, let me ask you that question.
Well, I personally think that Bush, particularly during the first year and a half of his presidency, wasted an opportunity to begin developing normal economic relations with the Soviet Union because he was afraid of the reaction by conservative Republicans. When he took office, Gorbachev had already done most of the things in the foreign policy area that the Reagan administration had said they would like to see before they really thought the Soviet Union had changed. Then Bush said that he was not prepared to begin normalizing economic relations unless the Soviets passed a new immigration law that codified their liberal immigration policies that had already begun under Gorbachev. Well, that wasn't in the law. The Jackson-Vanik Amendment, which was the law governing U.S.-Soviet trade relations, didn't require the Soviets to pass a law. In effect, Bush moved the goalpost back on Gorbachev and kept them there for another 2 years. And while it's impossible to say that better economic relations with the West would have strengthened Gorbachev, helped the Soviet economy, and prevented the coup attempt, it certainly wouldn't have hurt him.
It looks now that both Gorbachev and Yeltsin really owe something to Bush because of the way he backed them. How do you think that that favor might be repaid, or what do you think the United States might ask of them in return?
Well, I think that both Gorbachev and Yeltsin are appreciative, certainly, of not only what Bush did, but what the Western world did. I think that everybody will calculate, and probably correctly, that the people who initiated the coup wanted to pull it off in such a way as not to rupture their ties with the rest of the world. That's presumably why they tried to do it nonviolently. And the fact that the West immediately responded by saying that those ties will be ruptured regardless of how you handle a coup, as long as it's an unconstitutional and illegitimate government, I think had a role in the dissolution of the coup. Not a great role, but a role. And I think that the thing that the West will want in return is more of what has already been going on, and that is Soviet cooperation in addressing multinational problems, such as the Middle East or the Persian Gulf or the environment and so on. I don't think that there will be any payment required, but I do think that President Bush will be quite surprised if Yeltsin or Gorbachev or both of them don't continue to try to play a constructive role in the United Nations and in the solution to multinational problems.
Do you think there'll be pressure on the United States not to grant most favored nation status to the Soviet Union?
Well, I would assume that if Gorbachev resumes the presidency, as he appears to be about to do, that the trade agreement, which the president sent to Congress at the beginning of August, will be approved and that the Soviets will get their most favored nation status. The interesting question will be whether the West will be more disposed now to listen to Yeltsin's and Gorbachev's appeals for substantial direct aid as opposed to just normalized tariffs. I'm not sure what the response will be, but I suspect that there will be some who will say that we ought to make sure that we do what we can now that the hardliners have been vanquished and there doesn't seem to be any doubt about the bona fides of Gorbachev's and Yeltsin's devotion to democracy, that we ought to do what we can to try to help them get the economy on the move again and stabilize the country. On the other hand, there isn't a lot of cash around to do that with, and there are still a good argument to be made that it would be a waste of money to simply give them a big infusion of cash until they have finished the difficult job of restructuring the economy and preparing it to make good use of Western assistance.
So getting back to something that you just said, you see the lack of violence as a weapon used by the members of the coup. You see that as an indication that they wanted Western relations with the Soviet Union to continue.
That is the thing that I can't figure out. It would have been possible, I would think, for them to have had a couple of commando squads kill Gorbachev and kill Yeltsin at the beginning of the coup and attempt to decapitate the resistance. And I'm sure that in light of what's happened, there are a lot of coup supporters who wish that that's what they had done. I think the fact that they didn't do it suggests either that they completely miscalculated the political situation and thought that just by declaring a coup that an alienated populace would flock to their support, or that they wanted a coup but they didn't want to burn their bridges with the rest of the world, and therefore they tried to have it as nonviolently as possible to give it a veneer of constitutionality by having Inayev be the one to succeed Gorbachev and so forth. It was clearly miscalculated, but why exactly they didn't start off by disposing of the people who could rally opposition to the coup, I can only assume it's because they did not want to rupture completely their relations with the rest of the world.
You know, there was something almost funny about the lack of imagination showed by the leaders of the coup in the language that they used, in falling back on the old, oh, he's sick. He's sick, so we had to replace him. And then when a couple of the leaders of the coup were out, it was like, well, they have an unnamed illness or an unnamed
right.
condition. They couldn't even come up with they couldn't even come up with a name for the condition that was disabling them.
Right. Yeah, well, I guess the only explanation for it is that these are men in their 60s who spent the first 60 years of their lives in a Stalinist Brezhnevist system, and maybe they're a little too old to have learned completely. I don't know. I would have expected more of them. Certainly the fact that the KGB in recent years has started to try to polish its image in the Soviet media suggests that they were not entirely unsophisticated. But you're right, the coup smacked of the sort of old-fashioned Soviet big-lie tactics. Maybe that's the only way you can run a coup in the Soviet Union, is to just lie your way into it and try to brazen it out. But it certainly didn't persuade anybody that these people offered anything but a return to the past.
The head of the KGB was one of the people behind the coup. What do you think is going to happen with the KGB now?
Well, it's a very difficult thing to do, to dismantle a security operation like the KGB, and I don't think that Yeltsin or anybody else really wants to dismantle it completely. No modern government, and they look to the United States and other Western powers as their models, gets along without an internal security police and an external intelligence agency, and I think that they believe that they should have both. The question is the security agency and is the intelligence apparatus loyal to the presidency and to the established constitutional powers. So my suspicion would be that they will try to replace Kruchkov and probably some of his deputies, insofar as they know who was involved in the coup plotting, but that to a large degree the apparatus will remain intact.
Do you believe at all in the theory that's circulating in some quarters that Gorbachev was in on the coup?
Well, no. The most cogent reason against that is that if he were in on the coup, that would mean that somehow he had persuaded Kruchkov and Yazov and Yanayev and all these people to sacrifice themselves in order to strengthen his position. And there's no indication that that he could or would do that. They, after all, have been opposed to a lot of what he's been trying to do for at least a year, and he hasn't been able to even get them to resign. Now now you're asked to believe that he somehow persuaded them to expose themselves to criminal charges, and I just don't find that credible. The big question remains as to why the coup failed to remove Yeltsin as a threat from the beginning, and I really don't know the answer to that, except that the Soviet military didn't really understand what was required to stage a coup in Vilnius in January, and it could be that it's just hard-headed enough not to have learned how to anticipate the popular response to a coup and allowed Yeltsin, through incompetence, to remain a threat to them.
What do you think is going to happen to the leaders of the coup?
It's very, very difficult to guess. There's a lot of sentiment, obviously, now in the Russian parliament to try them for state crimes, and it may well be that some of them will be tried. I think, though, that there will be a stronger sentiment to try to put this behind both the Soviet and the Russian governments, and that in that with that objective, they will try to reach some kind of a compromise where maybe the individuals all resign and give up any chance of ever retaining a powerful position again, but are not prosecuted. But I can't predict that.
Given before the coup that there was only a 7% support for Gorbachev in the Soviet population, what do you think the reaction is going to be to his return to the presidency?
I think there will be a general acceptance of his return to the presidency, assuming that he goes ahead and submits, either resigns or retires, or submits himself to a genuine election sometime in the near future. And I think that's planned for next year, and I believe that he certainly will respect those plans. I think that people will, from this time forward, be more prepared to give Gorbachev his due as the person who brought the Soviet Union from a communist, semi-totalitarian state to the verge of democracy, and not to be so critical of him now that they've seen the kind of opposition that he had to face to get them as far as they've gotten.
Well, I wish you a good trip back to the Soviet Union. I hope you get to go there soon.
Thanks.
And thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Robert Cullen is the author of a forthcoming book on the crumbling of the Soviet Empire called Twilight of Empire. It's scheduled to be published in October. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If the KGB is the largest and perhaps the most feared intelligence agency in the world, why did the coup that its leader backed fail so quickly? Coming up, we put that question to former CIA Director Stansfield Turner. We also ask him why the coup appears to have caught our intelligence agencies by surprise. Writer Mikhail Yussel lived under the KGB during the Brezhnev years, his parents under Khrushchev, and his grandparents under Stalin. All of those experiences shaped his new collection of stories. We talk about the memories and feelings stirred up by the coup. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Air traffic controllers say that an airplane carrying Soviet leader Gorbachev has landed in Moscow. Earlier, as a coup collapsed, tanks pulled out of the center of Moscow and press bans were lifted. It's unclear where the eight men who staged the coup are tonight. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow. There is a lot of speculation, but very little hard information.
There have been rumors flying all over Moscow today. At one point, it was said that they were all headed toward Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia. That's one of the Soviet Central Asian republics. But then that rumor died down after a while. And instead, there were rumors that some of them had boarded a plane to go to Simferopol in the Crimea near where Gorbachev was. Some people said that Vladimir Kruchkov, the KGB chief, and one of the eight leaders of the coup had not gone with the rest of the members. We even heard reports that Defense Minister Dmitry Yazov had committed suicide. There are many, many calls for criminal prosecution, and the Soviet prosecutor general reportedly has launched an investigation.
NPR's Ann Cooper in Moscow. In a statement read for him on state-run television, Soviet President Gorbachev said that decisive actions by democratic forces in the nation defeated a coup against him. The statement said that Gorbachev is now in full control of the situation and had spoken by telephone with leaders of the various republics, agreeing that those taking part in the coup would be held fully responsible. The Baltic republics of Latvia and Estonia have declared their independence from the Soviet Union. This took place as Soviet troops started pulling out after a failed coup in Moscow. NPR's Michael Sullivan has more on the story.
The independence declarations came in the morning while Soviet troops still occupied key positions in the three Baltic republics. Estonia's foreign ministry said its decision was made due to the rapidly changing situation in the Soviet Union and was taken to assure the inalienable rights of the Estonian people. The Latvian declaration was approved at an emergency session of parliament in the capital, Riga. Shortly afterwards came the order from Defense Minister Dmitry Yazov for all Soviet troops to return to barracks. There is a report tonight that Lithuanian security guards and Soviet troops have exchanged fire in Vilnius. A Lithuanian government spokesman says that one Soviet soldier and one Lithuanian security guard were injured. Soviet forces in the other republics are continuing their withdrawal. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
President Bush spoke by telephone with Soviet leader Gorbachev around noon today and said later that coup leaders in Moscow underestimated the power of the people. Mr. Bush also said that ties between the United States and the Soviet Union will now be stronger than ever. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials climbed 88 points to close at 3,001.78 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Despite news that a Soviet coup had failed, NATO foreign ministers took a hard line with Moscow and said that Western aid will be resumed only if the Soviet Union returns to constitutional government. NATO foreign ministers condemned the coup and insisted that Moscow abide by all international commitments, including arms treaties and agreements to pull out troops still in Eastern Europe. The statement also said that the security of the new democracies in Eastern Europe must be respected, and that NATO would forge closer ties with them in order to encourage more changes. Israeli Prime Minister Shamir has welcomed news that a Soviet coup has failed, but has warned Jews in the Soviet Union not to be complacent. He called on them to immigrate immediately to Israel. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli officials breathed a sigh of relief at news that the Soviet coup had failed. Officials had been careful all week not to make any negative statements, but there was barely hidden fear for the safety of the Jews in the Soviet Union. Shamir's message to them was not to be complacent. You never know what tomorrow may bring, he said. Leave the Soviet Union now and immigrate to Israel. 200,000 Soviet Jews may arrive in Israel by the end of the year, in light of this week's events. This morning, Israeli officials were saying it could be some time until the peace process in the Middle East would again be of central concern. Speaking in Jerusalem, Prime Minister Shamir would not speculate whether the U.S.-Soviet-sponsored peace conference would still take place in mid-October, as originally envisioned, but he acknowledged that world attention could move quickly back from the drama in the Soviet Union to peace in the Middle East. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Tennessee Senator Albert Gore says that he will not run for the Democratic presidential nomination next year. Gore said in a statement that his family is more important than politics and personal ambition. Gore is the third leading Democrat in a month to decide not to make the race in 1992. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. President Bush says that the Soviet coup caught him by surprise. And it's doubtful that the Soviet hardliners who took power on Monday expected to be fleeing Moscow on Wednesday. In addition to the failure of the coup, there also seems to be a failure of intelligence on the part of the KGB and the CIA. My guest Stansfield Turner was the head of the CIA during the Carter administration. I asked Turner why he thinks the coup failed.
First of all, because it was poorly planned. I think probably put together at the very last minute because they were tremendously worried about this treaty that was supposed to have been signed yesterday between the central government and the republics. And secondly, because the depth of public opinion in the Soviet Union for democracy is even deeper than most of us had thought, and they just ran into too much public disapproval of what they had done.
Where does the failed coup leave the KGB?
Well, I think it must leave it weakened since the head of the KGB was part of it. We don't know what his status is at this time, whether he'll recover from this in any way. One wouldn't think so, but it's very difficult to tell at this time. We just don't have enough information. I think, though, that tells the KGB we've been downgraded and people are going to be much more suspicious of the KGB in governmental positions. They're going to be much more inclined to put controls on the KGB. All of that was coming. I met with the head of the KGB, Mr. Kruchkov, the one involved in this coup, last October in Moscow, and he was telling me at the time that he was beginning to adapt the KGB to a democracy, that he was doing a lot of the things that we've done in the last 14 years in this country in terms of opening up the KGB to public scrutiny, to parliamentary scrutiny, and this will accelerate that process.
President Bush said that we have the best intelligence system in the world, but no intelligence system can tell you everything. We're assuming that the CIA didn't know that the coup was about to happen, but do you think maybe the CIA knew more than we think they did?
I'm not inclined to think so. Predicting these individual coups or election reverses or other major events that have come as a surprise in foreign countries is very difficult. I've seen it happen. We've all seen it happen. For instance, in 1986, the intelligence of our country intercepted messages from Gaddafi to his units in Berlin and predicted that there was going to be a bombing, a terrorist attack, and there was, and we had tried to avoid it, but it didn't succeed. So you do get some of these tip-offs once in a while, and you want to keep trying for them. But the odds of getting one in a situation like this, a coup that probably was put together in a matter of a day or two, is not high. You just can't demand that much of the intelligence people. Keep them trying, but don't count on it.
What makes it so hard to find out about a coup?
For instance, here, if Yeltsin and Gorbachev didn't have any clue that what was going on inside their own organizations, obviously it was being very, very tightly held. You would have to have, well in advance of this coup, have placed somebody inside one of the camps that was involved here, in the military, in the KGB, in the Interior Ministry, in the vice president's office. You'd have to have some kind of an informant. The question is, would you have been able to get that? And would you have been fortunate enough that that person was in the right place, in the right office, that happened to be privy to what was going to take place? There's nothing the CIA works on more diligently than trying to, what we call, penetrate, get an agent inside the KGB. And since they didn't apparently have warning of this, it would indicate that they didn't have the right kind of person in this instance, even though they work on that very hard.
Do you think that the CIA has dismantled any of the spy equipment that it had in the Soviet Union during the Cold War?
I would hope not. I can't imagine the KGB dismantling theirs at this point. What I think is different today is that both sides will be more cautious about spying on the other in ways that would be very embarrassing if you were caught. It's more difficult to spy on somebody with whom you're on friendly terms than it is on someone with whom you're an adversarial relationship, because it just is very embarrassing when you get caught with a bug in somebody's office and it's attributed to the United States, let's say, and yet you're supposed to be on friendly relations. If it's an adversarial relationship, people accept that as part of the game that goes on.
Stansfield Turner directed the CIA during the Carter administration, and he's written a new book called Terrorism and Democracy. This is Fresh Air. One of the many Soviet émigrés in this country who's spent the past couple of days glued to the TV watching the coup is writer Mikhail Yussel. Yussel emigrated to America 5 years ago and now teaches at the University of Minnesota. His first collection of English short stories has just been published. It's called Every Hunter Wants to Know, and it's about growing up in Leningrad. In Yussel's latter Leningrad days, he wrote stories and translated American poetry and fiction for the Underground or Samizdat publications. Yussel told me he was followed by the KGB for about 6 months before he left his country. Yussel's parents still live in Leningrad. He was unable to reach them during the coup. When he heard the news this morning that the coup had apparently failed, he was very relieved, but not surprised.
I had no doubts whatsoever that that would how it turned out. That would be how it would turn out. But it probably now feels even better than if this hadn't happened in the first place, because now there is this sense of things having been cleaned somehow, that those people having exposed their hand, and now nothing will be like it used to, basically.
Was there a part of you that really wished you were in the Soviet Union these past couple of days, maybe especially today, watching the tanks turn around?
No, I didn't have the feeling that I need to be there, but I felt very strongly that I would very much like to know exactly what was going on with my parents. And at one paranoid moment, I had this vision of scores of KGB people walking from one apartment to another with a long list of people whose relatives are abroad and who have made themselves rash statements and probably arresting people and rounding people up. And I had that nightmare, and that was the only moment when I really wanted to be in Leningrad somehow for a very short period of time, just to get my parents out of there.
Now, your parents grew up in a more fearful time. Do you think that they would be, and that other people of their generation would be, more reluctant to take a stand now than younger people would be who grew up closer to the reforms?
Of course. And as a matter of fact, it was interesting to read in one of newspapers' report from the streets of Moscow and how quickly people feel, some people slip back into this habit of fear. People are refusing to give their last names to Western correspondents, saying they don't want to court trouble. And here in San Francisco, there is a one of the San Francisco State University's public channels carries a Soviet news program, Vremya, every night. And last night and the night before that, I was watching Soviet television news program, and eerie throwback to 6 years ago, how easily and how comfortably the anchor persons, people in the streets, some people in the streets, and how quickly they return to the language of the late 70s and early 80s. It's as if this distance had been just whatever happened in the last 6 years. It just underscored the fragility of the changes of the last 6 years.
When you talk about the language that preceded those changes, what kind of language are you talking about?
Oh, this Orwellian newspeak again, this state committee issuing decrees written in this monstrous language of Soviet newspapers circa late 70s. Again, this patriotism, Soviet people, patriotic efforts of Soviet people, deep satisfaction experienced by Soviet people at the sight of tanks in the streets of Moscow, this kind of thing.
There's a selection from your new collection of stories, Every Hunter Wants to Know, that I'd like you to read. And this is an autobiographical story? This is a story that the mother tells the son about the grandfather who was a Stalinist. Is this a story your mother told you?
Yes, it was. This particular story was the first that I wrote in English, and it's the only strictly autobiographical. It better be called an essay. That's why it precedes, the prefaces the book, as it were. And
now, your grandfather had been a Stalinist.
Not exactly, but he was sure, but not in a sense that is assigned to this word. He was not for Stalinist purges, or he was not standing for anything that Stalin. But he was an old Bolshevik, basically. So which means that he always went with the line of the party.
Let me ask you to read the passage from the story.
Okay. My mother once told me an interesting, revealing story about her parents and Stalin. The way I remember it is that when the news of Stalin's death was broken on the radio, that ubiquitous black dish on a white wall in the kitchen in March 1953, Stalin had been dead for at least a week by that time, my grandfather burst into uncontrollable tears. The whole country was weeping. Sobbing, he walked from the kitchen into his and my grandmother's room in their Moscow communal apartment, where my grandmother, upon hearing the same news on the radio, was rejoicing. Thank God, at last, that butcher, she exclaimed. She was a shrewd but also a very cautious woman, normally the wife of a party functionary. My grandfather had always thought, of course, that she too loved Stalin like everybody else. Not loved, not even adored, but rather cherished, worshipped him. As it turned out, he discovered she never did, and now under the influence of an overwhelming moment, she got carried away. She must have thought that my grandfather was still in the kitchen, but he was standing teary-eyed behind her back in their room, ready to share her grief. Her exclamation hit him hard. He was flabbergasted. I can't believe my ears. I've lived with an enemy of the people all these years, he erupted. I should mention here that ears and years don't rhyme in Russian, and his words didn't sound funny to either of them. My grandmother turned around, bit her tongue, and cursed her stupidity. But it was too late. He had already left, dramatically slamming the door shut behind him, gone forever. For a year, I was told. He went away for a year. A year doesn't sound right to me. Too epic. A day, maybe, or even possibly a week.
When did your mother tell you this story, and what did she see as the meaning of the story?
Well, I was 10, I think, around that time. She wanted to underscore the point, or rather to explain why my father and my grandfather had at times strained relations, when my father would actually needle and my grandfather and comment on certain development on TV, make a political joke that would drive my grandfather up the wall. So she would explain, say something that you need to be understanding around old people like grandfather, people of rigid beliefs, and people of principle who are unlike us.
In hearing the story about your grandfather and how, even after Stalin's death, he really mourned him. Does that give you insights into why people would remain hardliners, communist hardliners today?
Oh, sure. I suspect that their reasons might have been different than my grandfather's would have been. My grandfather had a dream, and he felt that of the worldwide revolution, and that was the dream that he tried to carry through his life. He was one of those Jewish teenagers from small towns in the Ukraine and Belarus who flocked to Petersburg, to Moscow and Leningrad in the early 20s with this idea of worldwide revolution in their hearts. People who were on the screens of our TVs just a couple of days ago, the state committee on the state of emergency in the Soviet Union, this committee of eight people, they're nothing like my grandfather used to be. They're nothing like old Bolsheviks. These are the people that have nostalgia for old good times, basically. And I can understand, of course, how they can be nostalgic. They were fighting for their political survival. I think they're regretting it deeply at this particular moment when they're roaming the mountains of Kyrgyzstan, trying to cross the border with China and asking themselves what it was that forced them to do this. But I don't think that they were particularly ideologically indoctrinated people. They were just people who were about to lose their jobs for good.
The people behind the coup, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, they were people who had power, lost it, and wanted it back again.
Wanted respect back, wanted power back, wanted fear back, wanted the simplicity, the uncomplicated the lifestyle back, wanted to see fear in people's eyes, wanted to see West go away. They wanted all host of things that they were not about to get.
My guest is Soviet emigre writer Mikhail Yussel. He has a new collection of short stories called Every Hunter Wants to Know. More with Yussel in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today on All Things Considered, the return of Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev to Moscow. National Public Radio will be covering the return of the Soviet president, who issued a statement which was read on Soviet television today, that he is completely in charge, that he is returning, that he has ordered the tanks out of Moscow. During the 90 minutes of All Things Considered and then continuing along as long as it appears necessary to continue, we will be talking about what has happened, why it has happened, and what will happen now. That's today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
My guest is Soviet emigre writer Mikhail Yussel. He emigrated from Leningrad 5 years ago and now teaches at the University of Minnesota. What were the breaks for you as a writer in the United States? Did you have any connections when you came here?
No, I didn't have connections. I knew some people. I had their phone numbers, and I knew that some of them knew some writers. But that to be in touch with writers, I knew that I needed to write something. And I kept trying to write in Russian, and somehow it did not work. It was not working, and because I was too excited. I was too nervous. I was too upset. I was too agonized, basically, to keep writing in Russian. And so I almost started writing in English as a lark, almost to prove to myself that I could do it, to put a distance between myself and the language and my past. Somehow, English has become ultimately the glass wall between myself and my past. This estrangement that this obstacle that every writer needs, basically. I think I'm overdoing it in the word basically. So at first I tried to write and I could literally see how I was translating things in my mind from Russian into English, and it did not work. But I kept trying to write, and eventually I wrote two short pieces and sent them to a graduate writing program, to the graduate writing program at the University of New Hampshire, and I was accepted there. And from that point on, it was all much easier, basically. It was all more or less normal writer's life, I would imagine, just working hard on your stories, writing and rewriting. And I had a feeling that I found myself in English, which was an important, very, very liberating feeling.
I know this is a question that's impossible to answer, but have you thought about what you might have been doing, how you might have behaved these past couple of days had you still been living in the Soviet Union?
Sure. I was thinking about it. As a matter of fact, I was listening into myself, and I was trying to find within myself traces of fear and a familiar sense of mixture of fear, anger, resentment, and sure enough, I found it all in myself very quickly. And I think that had I stayed in the Soviet Union, well, I'd be huddled with my friends somewhere in the kitchen, ranting and raving against those unfortunate human beings, those old-timers. But I might even be in the streets somewhere surrounding the building of parliament, but I'm not sure. I'm not 100% certain that I'd be there.
What are your plans for tonight? Are you going to be getting together with friends and watching CNN more? Will you be on the phone trying to call your family?
Both. Sure, I'll be watching. I'll be watching television, and I'll be trying to get through to the Soviet Union.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
Mikhail Yussel's new collection of short stories is called Every Hunter Wants to Know. It's published by Norton. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A Mideast peace conference is getting closer to reality, but in Israel there's strong objection to the conference from a variety of right-wing groups. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Israeli political scientist Ehud Sprinzak, the author of a new study of Israel's radical right. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.